You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A new documentary called Antarctic Edge, 70 degrees south, follows biological oceanographer Oscar Schofield and a team of researchers on their annual journey to study the effects of climate change in the fastest winter warming place on Earth, the West Antarctic Peninsula. It is directed by Dina Seidel, an award-winning filmmaker and director of the Rutgers Center for Digital Filmmaking, who joins us now along with Oscar Schofield, and Gabriella Elise, a film student senior at Rutgers University. The film opens tomorrow night at the Quad Cinema on West 13th Street. It's my great pleasure to welcome Dina, Oscar, and Gabriella to our show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard. Thank you. It's so great to be here.
Oscar, how long have you been studying the Antarctic?
I went down as an undergraduate senior. I skipped graduation to go on my first Antarctic cruise, and so that was 1988.
So it's been a while. Every year?
Yeah. No, I was going routinely till about 93, and then at that time I had a baby, and on that trip I was gone for 6 months, and I missed her birthday and decided I needed to stay home and do some other work for a while.
And I'd imagine this, you have to balance those things even today.
Yeah,
I mean, these are long trips.
These are the shortest trip you can take is about 8 weeks. It takes 10 days just to get from South America to the continent on the ship, and so that's 10 days plus then the science expedition.
It looks so close on the map.
Yeah, ships are slow. Yeah, a good ship, a good research ship.
I mean, you go
to
Europe in 5 days on a ship.
Yeah, you're riding the Gulf Stream. Yeah, here you're crossing the Drake, and the research vessels are, they're wonderful vessels, but they're not luxury liners. So,
Dina, how did the Rutgers University Film Bureau and the Rutgers Institute for Marine and Coastal Sciences come to work together on this project?
Well, that's a great question. Oscar and I have been working together for about 5 years now, and I started when I was in the English department teaching filmmaking as creative writing classes when Oscar and his team invited me in 2009 to come see what they were doing. They had learned of my background making documentaries for television, science documentaries. Well, to make a long story short, my students and I back in 2009 and 2010 made a feature film called Atlantic Crossing, a robot's daring mission following Oscar and Scott Glenn and their science team navigating an autonomous robot across the Atlantic Ocean. It was really a daring, somewhat crazy
scientific. And we talked about that on the show.
We did, yeah. You brought us on for that. It aired across the country on PBS stations, and it premiered at the Blue Ocean Film Festival. It was a big success, and it was in the Smithsonian. And then I learned of Oscar's science in Antarctica during that project, and then he and I thought, let's work on a proposal for the National Science Foundation, because his work is funded by the National Science Foundation. We got a grant to then go to Antarctica together and document his research as part of the long-term ecological research project in Antarctica.
Oh, was this your first trip to Antarctica?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Gabrielle, I imagine you as well. The first time you've been to Antarctica?
Well, Dina went to Antarctica. I joined the project after it was already filmed.
Doing what?
Well, I had the student perspective, so I was a part in sort of understanding, translating the science to what a student who doesn't have a science background can understand.
She's an editor as well, and she did a lot of
research. But it's important to make
well.
Something, a film like this understandable to people who might not understand otherwise. Oscar, you said you went there the first time in 1988. Have there been discernible changes over the years?
Yeah, so when I first went down there, we could go skiing out on the ocean in the wintertime, and it's very rarely got sea ice anymore. So the sea ice season down in that area is 90 days shorter a year than it was when 30 years ago.
That's 3 months.
3 months, most of the
winter. So the winter has shortened by 3 months?
Yeah. You know, the glacier behind Palmer Station where I worked back then sort of abutted right up against the field station. Now it's about retreated by about a football field, and we're finding islands that used to be covered by the glacier that now are getting named that we didn't know existed.
Since it's warmer, does that make it easier to travel in the area?
It does, in the sense when you don't have sea ice, it's easier for ships to come and go, but it's still a very windy and harsh place to work. And that still is the major detriment.
And some of it is still unmapped?
Even the parts that are mapped poorly. One of the big islands we work on, turns out when you look at the map, it's off by 5 kilometers on the map.
And as the film points out, it's sometimes difficult for ships to navigate through the water.
Yeah, the
bottom can be scraped.
Yeah, no, I was actually on a ship once where we rammed a rock pinnacle that wasn't on the map, and we didn't know if we were sinking at the time, and we had to muster with survival gear on the deck, and if you looked at the map, they didn't know that that rock finger even existed.
Dina, does shooting in a remote and forbidding environment present certain problems for a filmmaker that you might not face elsewhere?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That was a loaded question.
That was a totally loaded
question.
No, but you're completely right. So we're on a research vessel, small space, and it's just myself and ice photographer Chris Linder, and we had small gear. He was shooting with a DSLR, just a Nikon camera. I was shooting with a sort of a Sony FS 700 camera, not terribly big. We had, I think the biggest challenge for me as the director was how was I going to capture all the science? You've got 8 different science groups working 24/7. It's so expensive on that ship. Their research has to be done all the time. They're working like crazy. And the learning range for me, just trying to understand their science and capture it all. My biggest fear was not having enough material to come back and make a feature film. But of course, we're going out in little Zodiacs chasing whales to do whale biopsies and climbing, climbing islands with seals and penguins. It was super exciting.
And then you came up with some of the most stunningly beautiful landscapes anyone could ever hope to film. So you could just, if you needed to fill a little time, just simply move the camera across a landscape. But I assume that it's easier these days with digital equipment because sometimes the equipment used to freeze up in the old days.
Right. I mean, batteries still drain quickly in cold weather. Your hands freeze. There's one of our cameras got busted because I was on deck and a wave hit us. And, and when something breaks there, you can't go to B&H. You're pretty much on Mars, right? So there were tons of challenges, but I have to say I was more focused on how do I get enough material, and I came back with 400 hours of footage, which I then shaped with my former student co-producer Steve Holloway and 14 undergraduates over the course of 2 years, and that's actually the basis of our new film program at the university.
Oscar, what specifically does a biological oceanographer do?
So I'm interested in the food webs and how the physics and chemistry drives those food webs. And so our project's looking at, as we warm the system, as we make it windier, how's that going to ripple all the way through the plankton to the penguins?
So is plankton affected by the warming of the water? Is krill affected?
Yeah, so they're all affected differently. So the plankton, the small plants in the ocean, the forests of the sea are small, and one of the predictions is you could expect this area to get windier. And that leads to less growth. And we've seen that over 30 years. And then that translates directly to the krill because that's the food source to the krill. And the krill also need ice for breeding.
So, and then the krill, of course, are a food source
for
so many things else there.
Penguins, whales, seals. There's other fish that need the ice to survive. And so if you melt the sea ice back, they disappear.
And in films like this in the past, there were always lots of shots of penguins. There are still penguins here, but not as much as in the past. Are they disappearing, or did you just decide to focus on other things?
Well, one part was the cruise itself. So the ship is sort of doing a survey of the entire peninsula, and the penguins tend to be located at specific locations on the continent. So, one reason Dina didn't get as much penguin imagery was because she was out at sea, as part of the project. But up at Palmer Station, the Adelie penguin population has almost decreased by 90%.
Parts of the film were shot at Palmer Station, which you describe as summer camp for nerds. What's so nerdy about it?
It's awesome. It's like a fully outfitted research lab, and you really have no distractions. You're away from home, you have all the equipment, and you just work 24 hours a day doing your work for as much as you can.
Dina, what's it like being surrounded 24 hours a day by scientists who Oscar describes as nerds in a remote part of the world.
The scientists are really amazing people, and this particular team is super collaborative. And I mean, it was just an incredible honor. Really, they're doing amazing work that is important on just a global level. So it was a huge privilege. And what happens, Leonard, with these projects is you develop these relationships of trust with the scientists. And that's key because they're letting me into their lives. And they're exposing their human motivations, their goals, but also the details of their science. And they're trusting me to get that science right. So I think one of the challenging pieces was that Oscar had to convince his science team to let me in and to trust me because there had never been a documentary crew on that research vessel, and it's been going on for 20-some years now.
Why do you have to establish trust? They must have known that you were a friend if you were there with Oscar.
I think it's more that, you know, when you're working 24 hours a day, you're beat up because it's a rough day.
And you're away from family.
You're away from family, and you've got 3 hours to sleep before the next field station. And Dina needs input now. And so part of it is just getting everyone on board that when we need to give the input, we're going to do it.
Go ahead.
But I have to say, it's like the scientists range from William and Mary, Columbia University, Duke University, University of Colorado. They're from all over, and they were actually incredibly supportive for us to go out and get the grant and then tell their story.
And all from the United States? There were scientists in Antarctica from other parts of the world, too.
One of our formal partners in this project is the British Antarctic Survey. They're doing a similar project to the south of us out of the British base. But Antarctica as a whole is an international science preserve, essentially. And so we do collaborate with some of the communities to the north and south, but our main collaborators are with the British.
Are there ever rivalries? Do you have to fight with scientists from other parts of the world some access?
Not access, because the continent is open. If you're there to do science, that's what the continent is protected for. We will have the classic nerd rumble where we might disagree on data and stuff like that, or if trends are different to the north and south, you know, explaining that. But it's a collaborative atmosphere down there.
Dina, why did you decide to call the film Antarctica 70 Degrees South? Is that a particularly important
part of
the story?
Yeah. So 70 Degrees South is the location of Charcot Island, which is the final destination of the research crew. So that's the last Adélie penguin colony, and it was very hard to get to because of sea ice.
And you're going across the Antarctic circumpolar current?
Yeah.
That regulates Earth's temperature to some degree, doesn't it?
It's one of the largest current systems on the planet. It's got the force of about 30,000 Niagara Falls flowing through it. And it's really one of the big regulators of climate, and it's warming, and we don't know enough about it.
What was it like crossing it on ship?
The Drake Passage?
Yes.
When we went, it was high, the seas were high, but it wasn't as bad as it can be. We did have some pretty stormy days, 60-mile-hour winds. We never really know when the weather's going to be terrible and when it's not, and that's always sort of unpredictable. By the time we got to Charcot Island, that becomes the most dramatic part of the story, whether the scientists are actually going to get in.
My guests are Dina Seidel, filmmaker and director of Rutgers Center for Digital Filmmaking. Also from the Rutgers Center is Gabriella Elise, and we're talking with biological oceanographer Oscar Schofield, and we will continue our conversation after this. We are back with biological oceanographer Oscar Schofield, Dina Seidel, filmmaker and director of the Rutgers Center for Digital Filmmaking, and also Gabriella Elise, who is a senior at Rutgers University and was involved with editing a new film called Antarctic Edge, 70 Degrees South, which opens tomorrow night at the Quad Cinema on West 13th Street. You've said that going to Charcot Island is like traveling back in time.
It is. So the West Antarctic Peninsula is very long. It's like the eastern seaboard of the U.S. And if you go south, the climate is still polar. It's still very cold. And so up in the north, it's warming. And if you go south about 500 kilometers, it's what the north was 30 years ago. And then Charcot is what it was 60 years ago.
Now, we have heard about climate change in other parts of the world, although there are some people in Congress who say it's not true. But why is West Antarctic Peninsula the fastest winter warming place on Earth?
So one reason is its location. So the Antarctic Circumpolar Current circulates around the entire continent of Antarctica. And as winds increase in the Pacific, you push that current up against the continent. And that current is really warm. It's 4 degrees. And that's what's melting everything. The deep ocean is melting that part of the continent.
And is that telling us anything about how the planet will respond to climate change, the rest of the planet?
Yeah. The thing that's really nice about the West Antarctic Peninsula is compared to other areas, you can cover it in a ship on one expedition. And so you can study an entire system changing in a reasonable way. And so this is sort of our canary in the coal mine to understand what might happen in the north and other places in the south.
Does melting sea ice affect places closer to home, like our East Coast shoreline?
Yeah, so
California.
Sea ice doesn't affect sea level, but there's also the West Antarctic ice sheet that is on the continent over there. And it was just sort of declared a year ago to be in irreversible decline. And that's ice that's on the land, and that's melting into the ocean, and that will raise sea level. And there are some studies that actually suggest the Northeast will feel sea level more than other parts of the globe. And some of that sea level will be because of the West Antarctic ice sheet.
Are the warming ocean temperatures around Antarctica connected to the warming temperatures in the United States?
They're all interconnected. It's a very complicated picture.
Because I would think that South America and Africa would be more affected. They're closer to Antarctica.
Yeah. What we're doing is we're raising sort of the mean temperature of the planet very slowly. And then that heat is then changing the weather and the climate. And so we can get very cold winters here because the Gulf Stream is very wavy. Down south, we can actually lead to huge ice melt. And so the climate scientists are trying to unravel this huge jigsaw puzzle, essentially. And that's the science.
Dina, did you observe changes in Antarctica? Because you hadn't been there before, but could you observe changes while you were making the film?
I will say that I was surprised at how warm it was at Palmer Station. It was about 40 degrees. It was actually colder in New Jersey than where we were in Antarctica at that time. And we were just sort of wearing like little blazers while we were filming the penguin biologists putting sensors on the penguins.
What has been the position of the governor of New Jersey as far as climate change is concerned?
You'd say he was a skeptic in the beginning. He's modified his tone a great deal since Hurricane Sandy. But his position doesn't really affect us because we're funded more from the federal government side of things.
And some people argue that extreme weather events like Super Typhoon Haiyan, Katrina, Sandy are all related to climate change. Others have argued that this is just part of the normal weather trends that Earth has gone through throughout its long history.
There have been large cycles in heating and cooling of the Earth. That is a natural process. There are indications that the heating we're seeing now is more rapid than in the past. But if you think about it, it took the Earth tens of millions of years to make oil, and we will have burned it in 200 to 300. And that's an experiment we've already done.
You say that if we can't understand the ecology of the ocean, then we can't balance the carbon budget of the planet. What's the carbon balance?
So one of the things that's warming the planet is we're putting a lot of carbon dioxide up in the atmosphere, and that's what's keeping it warm. Some of that carbon dioxide gets sucked up by the ocean, and that's driven by some of the biology happening there. About half of the carbon we put up in the atmosphere is sucked into the ocean. And when I was a graduate student, we didn't know how much carbon went in the ocean, and it's half of the budget. And so
the water has more carbon in it?
Yep.
And what impact has that had?
Well, if you suck more carbon in, you make the oceans more acidic. And so there's this process called ocean acidification. And we're actually seeing that. There's a lot of concern that it'll impact things like coral reef and those animals that have calcium carbonate shells.
You've also said that the Adélie penguins are the canary in the mine for climate change. Why are they their numbers declining?
So up in where we work at the Palmer area, there's a few things going on. One thing is the food that is available to them, the krill, the fish, that's changing because the sea ice has disappeared. On top of it, as the area gets warmer, you start getting more snow because the atmosphere is more moist, and the penguins aren't necessarily well adapted to protect their eggs from snow melt because they're not used to it. They're used to a polar environment. So they're getting hit from several different directions. And what's happening is you're finding animals that live to the north in South America or the Falkland Islands moving into this area. We find grasses now growing in the West Antarctic Peninsula, and probably by the time I retire, they'll be rooted plants.
So the food chain changes.
Yes.
But that also would mean that some species might go extinct?
I mean, that's the big question, is who's going to win and who's going to lose? And so part of our project over the last 20 years is to try to understand who are going to be those winners and losers. Whales can move around. They can move further to the south. Penguins form their colonies in the same location year after year. And so they're likely to be much more sensitive to change.
I'm talking with biological oceanographer Oscar Schofield, also with filmmaker Dina Seidel and film student Gabriella Elise. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The film under discussion, Antarctic Edge, 70 Degrees South, which opens tomorrow at Quad Cinema on West 43rd Street. Gabriella, part of your role here is to make this film comprehensible to people who might not understand science under other circumstances?
Sure. I worked on the film as an assistant editor studying under my professor, Dina Seidel. And the translating from Oscar's incredible vast science knowledge to a regular audience member is an important process.
Well, so many politicians, when they talk about climate change, say, well, I'm not a scientist, so I can't talk about it. But if we all kind of understand the science here, maybe we all can talk about it?
Oh, well, I'm talking about climate change with my peers, and I'm an art student because we've been able to understand the importance of the climate change through this documentary process, and it's a hot topic among my non-science friends.
As we gear up for the 2016 presidential race, a number of candidates are on record as saying that climate change isn't real and that they do not support any limits on carbon emissions. Do any of you see that position as irresponsible?
Well,
I do.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. We know that it's very important to communicate the science and to make climate change a topic that everybody is talking about. And what's been very exciting for us and our partnership over these many years between our art film school and the marine sciences is that we're allowing a conversation, and we're engaging a big audience within the university, which then is communicating science to the larger public.
Why do you think, as a scientist, Oscar, why do you think that a number of politicians have said that there's a kind of a scientific conspiracy in discussing this?
Well, sometimes I'll say that it's a way for us to keep grant funding coming in, and it'll make us rich. There's probably better ways to get rich if that's your plan. I think the big issue is there's really a strong science consensus that the climate's changing. And now we're stuck with the policy decisions, and that's a political process. And so to sort of stall the policy discussion, they focus on the uncertainty of what we don't know in the science or debate. And the problem is I think the rest of the world is moving ahead and coming up with solutions, and we're not even preparing for those changes.
But China is not. China right now has just surpassed the United States as the world's largest polluter.
On the other hand, they've degraded their environment so rapidly that now they're stepping in and are talking, you know. But I think, you know, I would rather us to be leading, you know, not only in the sense of protecting our climate and our globe, but also there's going to be a lot of industries that are going to benefit from this, and I would rather those are homegrown industries. And so, you know, I think sort of putting our head in the sand and saying this isn't happening is slowing us down in all those other fronts.
Is this a war between older industries and newer industries? Because I'm thinking the two largest coal companies in the United States, along with 14 coal-producing states, have challenged President Obama's bill to curb carbon pollution, or not his bill, but his executive order to curb carbon pollution from coal-fired power plants. What will happen if we don't curb coal-fired energy?
Well, what's going to happen if we don't change our energy profile is we will likely accelerate the change. So in the Northeast here, sea level will continue to rise. And what that effectively does, even if it's a slower process, is essentially going to make smaller and smaller storms feel like larger and larger storms.
Dina, you wanted to add?
Well, I wanted to say in terms of affecting public policy, that's part of what we're doing here, that our scientists are doing amazing work, and there's lots of amazing scientists at our university, but they're not trained to communicate their science, right? And their goal, they're using a language that is about collecting data and expressing what is objective truths. So if you partner with us, the artists, right, and the storytellers, and the way we work, the language we use is character, story, emotional truths, right? And we are creating a narrative that a lot of people can understand, and we're following scientists that and their scientific process. And so by communicating that science to a large audience, it does affect public opinion, which then drives policy or potentially can affect policy.
Did you enter into this project with preconceived notions about what you wanted to communicate in this film?
I entered this project knowing that the story and the people are doing big things with there's a lot at stake. It's important. They're dynamic. There's a lot at risk, and they're passionate. And I know it's an incredible story. I know it's meaningful. And I know it because their goals, right, in a narrative, the goals of our characters are big, and it's something that the audience can relate to. It's absolutely a great story. And it's one of actually several stories that we do at our at Rutgers Film Bureau.
And, Gabriella, I'm sure that when you looked at the footage and you saw just how beautiful some of the images are, you just appreciated them on an aesthetic level. And worried perhaps that we won't have some of these things in the future?
Yeah, certainly. You know, we're the next generation, and my kids are going to have to face the climate change that we've been causing. So it's beautiful to look at these wonderfully cinematographic images that Dina and Chris Linder have made for us, but it's sad at the same time that we're losing them.
You're going to be going back next year, Oscar?
Yeah, I think so. I just got back about a month and a half ago. I leave usually right after Christmas and then get back mid-February, and that's our annual expedition.
Because that's summertime.
That's the summertime
south,
down
it's
there.
It's a little easier to move around during our winter months.
And that's when the biology turns on. It's just like, you know, here in the Northeast, once spring hits and summer, all the life comes alive, and that's what we're there to measure.
Do you assume that now that that we've lost 90 days of ice, that it's going to continue and that we'll soon be losing 120 days of ice?
That's actually, for the next 5 years, is one big focus for us. Is, you know, there are other natural climate cycles. There's El Nino, there's La Nina. It turns out...
Are they affected by what's happening here?
Yeah, well, they're actually partially the drivers. So, you know, our influence is one part, these other climate cycles, and how do they add up? And some cancel each other out, some add up. And so we're trying to decode that as a group.
I thank you all so much for being on our show. Antarctic Edge, 70 Degrees South, opens tomorrow night at the Quad Cinema at 34 West 13th Street. If you want more information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. My great thanks to our three guests, Oscar Schofield, a biological oceanographer, Dina Seidel, an award-winning filmmaker, director of the Rutgers Center for Digital Filmmaking, and one of her students, Gabriella Elise. It's been a pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leonard. It was great to be here.